Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen, here with Mark Thiessen and Yuona Thiessen, the Thiessen clan, on this Thursday, August the 6th, 2015. And we're in a very forgiving mood today because we're going to talk about the neuroanatomy of forgiveness. Now, I have to admit, I didn't know forgiveness had a neuroanatomy. In fact, I didn't know forgiveness even had a nervous system. So this is really news to me. So, Yuona, you're going to have to clue us in. First of all, when did forgiveness acquire a nervous system? And second of all, how does it work?
Well, forgiveness doesn't have a nervous system. And as a result, when we experience forgiveness, there is a certain observable pattern in the brain that is associated with that activity.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what the scientists wanted to study. They wanted to see what areas of the brain are involved in the act of forgiveness. And, you know, based on previous studies, they know about the neuroanatomy of the brain. When certain structures, certain areas are activated, they have an idea of what the processing, the thought patterns are associated with those areas are.
Okay. So I presume they're plugging people in and looking at levers and such, you know, bells and whistles to find out what they're actually measuring. But what are they measuring? What is it, just electronic signals, or what are they measuring?
No, so they're using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, you know, like when you want to see what's wrong with some part of your body, and they put you through that horizontal tube thing, that's the MRI.
Right.
And so what they're looking at in the brain specifically is blood flow as an indication of increased activity to that area.
Okay.
So the assumption is that when a certain area is activated, the neurons get involved, and because neurons don't store energy, the blood, you know, there's an increase of blood flow to that area to supply energy to the neurons, which are now more active than they were. So it's all kind of relative.
All kind of relative. So basically, we're talking about a clan here.
Well, no, relatives in terms of, you know, there's a baseline. Was that a joke? I didn't miss that.
If you have to explain a joke, it wasn't very good, so don't worry about it.
No, sometimes I get so, you know, into the academics, I miss the lighter side of the conversation, but that's okay.
I'm used to, you know, da-da-dum, it works for me, you know, so.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, there's a baseline activity, then there's an activity in terms of what happens during the event, and then what happens after the event, and so they use all kinds of fancy, software to kind of measure and calculate those things.
Okay. And what's the upshot? What have they actually found? I mean, is there anything to be learned about forgiveness?
Absolutely. There's quite a lot to be learned about forgiveness. And I just have to say that, you know, a lot of the reason I was interested in is because a lot of the New Age teaching, you know, they talk a lot about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Mark is a huge proponent of course, it's miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And their big emphasis is on forgiveness. And, you know, not just that, but also with even the Buddhist meditation, you know, they're big on compassion meditation, which is essentially about forgiving everything and everyone. And even that thing we talked about some time ago, the Ho'oponopono, where you engage in active forgiveness of people with certain issues, and it helped in their healing. But so forgiveness, right? We all have experienced forgiveness, and we've all actually engaged in forgiveness. Maybe not as much as we should, based on this study. But what they did was they had a group of people, and they had them inside of the MRI machine, and so they can get baseline measures of their brain, and you know, see what regions of the brain are active compared to others.
How many people did they have in there? I mean, it must have been crowded.
Well, one at a time.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I won't tell you some of the research that they do with physical intimacy. Haha, that's a whole different
thing. I'm not sure I want to have an MRI there. I mean, really.
Wow. Uh-oh, now Mark is...
So they got two in there, I guess.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it's a bigger one. But okay.
So you got to watch the way you say those things, Ioana.
Hey, that's what scientists do, you know?
Who knew it was so much fun to be a scientist?
Exactly. Yeah, so anyway, so they had one at a time inside of the fMRI machine, and what they did was they had them listen to audio of a recording, which was basically a story, and in that story there were the narrator is relating an event, something happens, and it's usually a story of deception or betrayal, or you know, the usual things that generate you know, some kind of emotional hurt for most of us. And then after that, they asked, you know, the patient, the subject.
Patient, yeah, they're going to be a patient by the time they're done.
Yes. How, you know, what they were feeling. So they had to explain their state and relay that to the scientists, and they would then, you know, correlate that with what they were seeing on the readout from the fMRI machine. And then, finally, they would offer the subject the opportunity to, because the stories were made to be personal and subjective, you know, so they were, it was saying, if this happened to you, you know, if somebody, you know, said something mean to you or whatever. And then they asked them, if you had the opportunity to forgive in this situation, what would you do? I mean, would you forgive or not? And then they asked them to actually describe this forgiveness process such that they can experience it and then record again the changes that were happening in their brain as they did this.
So a bit hypothetical, but it does have at least some correlation with what people know, you know, from their everyday lives.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that even though it's hypothetical, it reinforces something that we've always talked about here when it comes to neuroscience, that, you know, the brain does not make distinction between hypothetical and real situations in terms of how it responds, unfortunately or fortunately.
Which actually does lead to the question, what is real? But we won't even go there today.
Right, exactly, yes. So, you know, these people were in a hypothetical situation, but they were responding as though they were in the real situation. And so they were given the opportunity to forgive or not. And based on those who chose to forgive, they saw some very distinct changes that were common with all the people who chose to forgive as opposed to those who did not.
Such as?
So they saw there were very specific areas of the brain that were activated in people who were experiencing forgiveness that were not activated with those who chose not to forgive. And the first one was the prefrontal cortex.
Of course.
Remember him?
Yeah, we kind of expected that was going to be kicking in here somewhere.
Yes, because, you know, I was sharing this with Mark, and as I was reading this research, I was reminded of the fact that our prefrontal cortex is akin to a superpower that we either are unaware of, or if we are aware of it, we tend to take it for granted. Because the prefrontal cortex is involved in what they call top-down processing.
Okay.
So it allows us then to regulate and to mostly inhibit our negative emotions, because the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain, you know, that's the part of the brain that's the last to develop in the human adult. you know, because it matures very late compared to the rest of the brain. And it's what distinguishes us from other animals and other life forms. But the prefrontal cortex allows us to inhibit our negative emotions by using what is called the theory of mind, or what we described as that whole metacognition, where we're able to actually step outside of the situation and take an objective look at it, and then, you know, evaluate it in terms of the big picture, and as opposed to focusing specifically on that one event. And so the prefrontal cortex is very important in exercising forgiveness and most other types of what is known as mature positive emotions. So, and it's also involved in things like, you know, one of the things that the prefrontal cortex does, it's what is believed to be the area where our imagination is located. So it helps us to make, to bring to our awareness information that may not be present physically, so we can see things that are not there. And we can...
And thereby confuse ourselves about reality. Okay, I get it.
Well, yeah, because you know what? We probably already are in the negative. The prefrontal cortex then helps us to do it in a more mature way.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so it then helps us to do things like see things from the other person's perspective, or, you know, understand where they're coming from or why they might be doing what they're doing that might be offending us. It does other things like help us delay gratification, help us to, you know, to be flexible as far as our response to certain activities, so that it's not so. What's the word? When you respond without thinking.
Reflex.
Right, there we go. So it's not so reflexive, not so automatic, And you know, it's where it's believed to be the seat of our emotional and social intelligence, so that we can step outside of ourselves and really understand other people and see where they're coming from and realize, you know, that they might be going through something. So somebody says something offensive to you and you're hurt by it, but then you're able to say or to think, maybe they're afraid, or they're angry, or they're confused, which is why they're responding the way that they are. And so you're able to then not respond in kind, but to actually eventually, hopefully, forgive them for that.
So let's tie all that together, because we were originally talking about what they discovered about the prefrontal cortex and its relationship to the concept of forgiveness. What did they actually find?
So when you don't forgive, that area is not activated. So that's the important thing. So when you do forgive, so they're seeing that there's some inhibition of the negative emotion, there's the evaluating of the situation, there is understanding of the other person's perspective. So all of that they're assuming is happening, which does not happen when a person does not forgive. So what they see happening with the person who's not forgive, there are other areas of the brain that are involved, mostly the area involved in the self-perception, which is understandable. The New Agers would call that the ego area of the brain,
mm-hmm.
But it's the area where you're able to see yourself as the separate from everything and everybody else, and evaluate your space and think about you and how this whole thing relates to you and how you're affected, kind of thing. And so that's mostly what's going on with the person who's having a hard time forgiving.
Whereas the person who is forgiving, they've got an active cortex and they're demonstrating actual activity in that region of the brain, and
correct.
That's also the same region of the brain where all the creative stuff happens. So
yes.
It sounds like you're saying that the act of forgiving is a way of kind of rebooting your creative side.
Yes, exactly. And it's not just a creative side. Interestingly, you know, they talk about other areas of the brain that were activated as well. And, you know, there are other areas that were involved that were activated when you are forgiving. And one of that is the area that is controlled mental and biological homeostasis, which is similar to the rebooting. So it's, you know, when you're offended, you tend to experience stressful emotions. You know, cortisol and all the other stress hormones are released during an offensive type event. But there are other areas of the brain, in particular, the intraparietal lobe, that helps to rebalance things, to bring it back to rein in the cortisol and allow the more peaceful, calm state to resume. So yeah, there is definitely rebooting going on when you're forgiving and releasing of the pent up negative energy that might have been happening.
And in computerese talk, it's kind of like having an undo button.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very powerful undo button, because what you're undoing is all the negative karm that you're doing to yourself when you harbor unforgiveness. You know, there's a famous quotation that is always credited to Nelson Mandela, but actually it's Marianne Williamson, who first said it. That, no, maybe I'm confusing two things, because she's the one who said playing small mm-hmm. is not serving anybody, and he mm-hmm. said that also. But he did say that harboring unforgiveness is like ingesting poison and expecting someone else to die.
Oh, right.
Yes,
that's a number of people say that. And I think it derives from an old Buddhist.
Well, probably. But, yes. Because he was asked how was he able to forgive his captors when he was in prison for 27 right. years. And he mm-hmm. said if he didn't, he would not have survived.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, though, that it is... It's literally not what we would expect it to be. We think of forgiveness in terms of how it's going to impact the person we're forgiving.
Right.
But in reality, from what you're describing, forgiveness has a tremendously greater impact on ourselves and for the positive.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that's why I think all of the, the Buddhist sages and the Course in Miracles, they encourage you to forgive, because, you know, forgiveness is not just something that you do for others. It's also, you can forgive yourself. There's a lot of self-forgiveness that's also important, you know, because we have a lot of things we've done that we regret, or we're angry about, or we're mad at ourselves for, or we wish it we'd done differently. And just as harboring unforgiveness to other people can be physically and emotionally damaging, harboring unforgiveness towards yourself can have the very same effect.
And it's probably more common, too, because
yes.
people tend to beat themselves up pretty easily.
Right, a lot. And so, the research is showing that just forgiving yourself, and they went on to talk about some of the health benefits that come. Because, you know, they talk about unforgiveness, which involves holding a grudge and ruminating over and over. So it's almost as if, you know, the negative effect that event had on you, it's now having it recurring every time you kind of replay that event. And what happens is then you induce this almost chronic state of stress on your system that is damaging. You know, and I always talk about cortisol being released, and cortisol is very damaging to the brain and other tissues in the body. And unforgiveness, you know, psychology research has shown that unforgiveness is associated with a high risk for cardiovascular diseases, depression, and even some cancers are associated with people harboring unforgiveness. And so what they're showing is that forgiveness has all these positive health effects. And now the neuroscience is helping us to understand that, why that is so. Because when you get the prefrontal cortex involved, one of the things that the prefrontal cortex does is that it suppresses the activity of the amygdala and the hypothalamus, the areas of the brain involved with aggression and fear and all the negative emotions. And so it reins those in, and so those negative emotions and the biochemistry of that, all those negative emotions are curtailed, so that then the positive state can predominate, and that is associated with healing and therapeutic type activity on the system.
In essence, what we're talking about here is people who, for instance, carry a grudge against somebody, and you present them with the idea of forgiving that person, and they reject it out of hand. They give you all the reasons why they're not going to, and then from what you're describing, they end up playing the scenario over and over again in their minds, reinforcing it over and over again. So the one thing that happens that they don't like, that they're not willing to forgive, is what they continue to subject themselves to repeatedly.
Exactly, yes. Unfortunately, that is exactly what happens. Yes, so long after the offending person is gone, you are now, you have now assumed the role of the offender. Right? And so now you are replaying that offense to yourself over and over again.
It reinforces to me just how non-rational we human beings are.
I know!
I've been thinking about this issue a lot lately, I have to tell you. And I've really begun to realize that there's no such thing as rationality. It doesn't really exist. We tend to use it at times, particularly when it's convenient to do so. But in the back of everything that we want to do is emotion. And right. The emotion is what governs it. And when we talk about and think about stuff from a negative emotional state, we set ourselves up in all these different ways to reinforce the very things that we're against.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing rational about that at all.
Right, at all. And that's why, practices like meditation and other type of awareness type activities are so important. Because it's only through those kinds of activities we get out of that cycle.
Mm.
You know, we free ourselves from being under the control of our emotions, and we're able to, as we're learning here, allow higher areas of our brain to have more of an effect and be, to be more in control as opposed to having our emotions in control.
And based on the information you're sharing tonight, we can add a tool to that toolbox because forgiveness becomes a way out.
Yes. Yes, forgiveness is definitely a way out. But the thing about meditation is that when you practice meditation, especially the compassion type meditation, as it talks about in some Buddhist sects, is that forgiveness doesn't just become a way out, forgiveness becomes a way of life.
Mm.
Yeah.
That raises an interesting question, too, in my mind. Not so much that particular reasoning, but the concept of forgiveness in somebody who has trouble forgiving. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, I've always wondered, how much of a difference it makes from say, a metaphysical viewpoint. But I think I can now ask from a scientific viewpoint, because you've looked at the studies to see what they're doing. What happens when somebody tries to fake forgiveness and they don't really have their heart in it? Does it actually do anything? Does it reach the prefrontal cortex?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
No.
So there has to be something genuine there.
Yes, and that's the key, because if the forgiveness is not genuine and it's not at the level of the prefrontal cortex, then what you're doing is you're basically trying to pit one negative emotion against another.
Mm-hmm.
So you're still angry, you're still afraid, but then you're trying to kind of replace that, and so there's still that, still holding on to that, the grudge. You haven't released it, because when the prefrontal cortex comes involved, there is it's not an excusing of the event or condoning it or trying to ignore, pretend it didn't happen. What it is a different look at it. You're looking at it from a different perspective altogether. So your relationship with the event changes.
And how exactly does the relationship have to change? Because I imagine it's not enough to just disconnect from it. In fact, that's probably not a good thing at all, just disconnecting.
No. So what happens when your relationship with that event changes, you now see the event in a different light. So you see it, the meaning of it in terms of how it, affects you is different. So even when you think about it again, it doesn't conjure up the same negative emotions that it did originally.
So for somebody who does struggle with with forgiveness. You know, they're up against a really bad situation. Something terrible happened to them that somebody else did, and they just have not been able to forgive that person. Well, from what you're describing, we now know that that person who's unable to forgive is actually hurting themselves by doing so. Even when they try to pretend that they're forgiving just to mollify somebody, they're still hurting themselves. So right. That's not going to be an effective tactic. They really need to find a way to forgive, not for the purpose of saying what the other person did was right or what the other person did was good, but simply seeing it from a different perspective. That's a lot right there. Just trying to fathom that. Fathoming what it's like to see it and to experience it from a different perspective, particularly if it's something you've been holding on to for a long time.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it is challenging, but as we're learning about the brain, it's very malleable, it's very changeable. So what we know is that when you ruminate about a particular event, you're basically firing the same emotions, right, over and over again. So what you can do is try to fire different emotions. So you're still angry, you're still upset, but you can try to activate a different pathway initially. And so every time that event comes to mind and you feel the negative emotion, you can try to find some way to look at it differently and try to kind of run that pathway. What's the electrical term for that? Try to run that pathway and over again, you know? And you try to do that as often as the emotions come up, because what you're trying to do now is replace that neural connection that is associated with the event with a completely different one.
Well, I've often tried to fire my emotions, and they insist on keeping the job, so I don't think that's quite what you have in mind. But
yes, there's that English language for you again, fire and fire.
So anyway, we're due for a break. Let's take the break, and then after the break, let's go a little bit more into what it takes to actually change that thought process so you can get into a more forgiving mode, because it sounds like this is pretty essential to all of our mental health.
Okay, yes.
Okay, this is LOA Today here on PRN. We'll be back after these messages. Bring me down, came numb. Bring me down, the love is too high. Bring me down, came numb. Bring me down, I said. Bring me down, came numb. Bring me down, the love is too high. Bring me down, came numb. Bring me down, I said. Drop alone if you got. Welcome back to LOA Today. Walt, Mark, and Yuona. August the 6th, talking about forgiveness, the important role it plays in our ability to get ourselves back on track. It's actually for our own benefit that we forgive, not for those to whom we offer the forgiveness. It's actually for ourselves. And before the break, we talked about how it can be challenging. You're up against something that, you know, particularly something that's been chronic, perhaps it's been hanging around in your life for a long time, and you just have a hard time letting go of it. So you want to give us some strategies based on the research. What are good ways to let go and to actually feel the forgiveness so that we can get ourselves into the better place that we need to be?
Okay, so, you know, the first thing that is important, as you mentioned earlier, that, you know, the forgiveness is not about the other person. This is important for yourself, for right. Your own personal sense of well-being. You know, it's your life and your health that's at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's important to understand that. And the other thing is that, you know, forgiveness is an activity of growth and maturity. And sometimes it does take time to come to that place, especially if the event has been pretty traumatic. And, you know, I can't determine how a person feels about their event. You know,
well, if it's chronic, it's probably pretty bad, because even if it was not a severe event in and of itself, if it keeps on going, you're faced with it constantly.
Yes, right. But you know, yeah, that's true. And the thing is that we know that it is possible even to forgive under those circumstances, right? Because we've had records of in history of, you know, people who are famous for having forgiven, and some of them, you know, who, you know, it's been done. It's possible, and I think
so. Happily, we know that. Happily, we know it can be done. Now we just have to learn to do it.
Right, exactly. And I think understanding how important it is helps people to do that.
I think you've actually outlined that pretty well so far. Okay. I mean, you made it pretty clear that we need to do this. This is important.
Right. So one of the first things you have to would be helpful is to try to, as I was saying, fire a different neural pattern. And you can do that by, as we learned, we have this amazing tool, the amazing resource called a prefrontal cortex that we can use, right? We can use our imagination. And one of the ways that we can use our imagination is to rewrite the script. That is something that's available to us. We can rewrite the event, and you can change as much and as little as you want about it. You can rewrite how you responded, how the person acted, how you felt. You can rewrite, you know, the intensity, or, you know, you can rewrite just the circumstances surrounding what's happening. You can rewrite in terms of what the other person or people's motivations are. You know, there's so many ways that you can rewrite the story so that the neural network that's associated with this event changes. Because the goal is to get your brain and your body to not respond by producing all the negative, stressful, you know, hormones associated with this event, and to produce positive events, positive emotions, positive hormones, positive biochemistry in its place. And so one of the ways you can do that is by rewriting the whole script. You can, you know, actually write it down in pen and paper or type it, or you can use your imagination and just kind of imagine a whole different story and try to replay that, you know, like a movie script replaying in your brain as often as you possibly can.
It sounds like part of the strategy here then is to look at what did happen and then try to decide which parts you don't want to have to keep reliving, so that those are the parts you focus on rewriting, and then coming up with something that is quite different from what originally happened, and then basically pretending it really is going to work out the other way once you forgive.
Yes, it is.
Which is an interesting thing, because we're trying to use forgiveness in order to get to the prefrontal cortex so we can get back into the positive creative mode, and we're getting there by using the prefrontal cortex to get us back into the positive mode. It's like this endless cycle.
Yeah, so that, because you know what, the goal is to have your prefrontal cortex be in charge. And whether that is actually happening or you are making that happen is not so important, because for a lack of use, our prefrontal cortex sometimes can be confined or...
Can atrophy.
Yes, it can atrophy, or it can fail to grow and develop in the first place.
Is it inaccurate to say that our prefrontal cortex is, in a sense, our conscious mind and our conscious will?
So it's the will more than conscious.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a problem with the use of the word conscious,
it's basically
yeah.
exerting our will. It's basically yes. saying, I'm going to exert my will to change the way I feel about an event so I can feel it differently from now on.
Exactly. That's the word. Because you want to change from being the victim to being in charge of you.
That's quite a thing, because we've been told many times that it isn't about willpower, especially with like addictions and so forth. It's not about willpower. But you're kind of, in a sense, contradicting that. You're basically saying the research tells us willpower can actually accomplish a lot. It may not be able to accomplish everything, but certainly if you apply willpower in the case of an abuse situation or a neglect situation or something even more severe than that, and use your will to will yourself to forgive, even though you know what they did is wrong, not because you're trying to do anything for them, but because you're trying to do something for yourself, that will can actually be very efficacious. It can be very effective in getting yourself into a better place.
Yes. And here's the interesting thing. It's funny that you would bring up the will, the idea of willpower, and relate that to the prefrontal cortex, because there are a lot of people who do believe that the willpower and the prefrontal cortex are one and the same. The challenge is that for a lot of us, our willpower is weak. So whether it's because it's not fully developed or it's been weakened by life, by stress, by abuse, whatever the case is, it's weakened.
Maybe even by lack of use.
Yes, by lack of use, exactly. That's probably one of the biggest cause for a weakened willpower. So you know, when you say, you know, to people, use your willpower, you have to understand that for some people that may not be an option as much.
It's like it's too hard.
Yes. Well, I shouldn't say it's not an option, but it may be more difficult than for others. So there are people who have well-developed, strengthened, powerful willpower, and there are others who, for whom will using their use of their willpower is much a much greater challenge. But like everything else that we're learning, it can be developed. It can be enhanced. It can be strengthened. You can grow your willpower. You can even develop your prefrontal cortex.
So you don't have to remain the 98-pound willful weakling. You can become a super manly willful.
That's right.
Sounds like something out of an ad in the back of a magazine.
Yeah, the beautiful thing about all of this is that you can use the very same prefrontal cortex to develop your prefrontal cortex.
That's what's so weird about this. You're using the thing to build the thing.
Yeah, because you can use your prefrontal cortex, you can use your powers of imagination and all your ability to see things as you would like them to be, and use that as a source of strength, as it were, to draw you towards that person, to that place in your life, you know. And it all involves using your prefrontal cortex, and it gets to the place where when the prefrontal cortex is strengthened and empowered, then it becomes much easier to forgive, to be happy all the time, to be positive, to be loving, and all the other good stuff.
Okay, so for the 98-pound weaklings out there, mm-hmm. who just don't have a strong will, what can we recommend in terms of, you know, lifting those barbells to get themselves a little bit stronger? What kind of exercises, activities, thought games, whatever, what can we get them to do to help them build their willpower?
So one of the strongest ways to build your willpower is to actually meditate, which seems kind of ironic because you're like doing nothing to get something done.
It's very Zen of you.
You know, here's the reason why. The reason why most of our prefrontal cortex is not strong, powerful, well-developed is because we live basically predominated by our emotional brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the prefrontal cortex is all about top-down processing, but we spend most of our lives in the bottom-up processing. So we need to reverse that, and meditation helps us do that, because what it does is when you're in the meditation mode, you are basically quieting that emotional part of your brain. You are depriving it of activity, of engagement, or whatever the word may be, and you're allowing the prefrontal cortex now to actually come alive and to have some say in how you live your life. And the more you do that, the stronger the prefrontal cortex grows. Because, you know, if you remember, one of the things we learned from people who meditate regularly, that area of their brain is much more well-developed than others who don't meditate.
So in metaphorical terms, in a sense, what you're doing with meditation is you're getting the beach bully out of the way so he can't get in your way, and that allows your very weak prefrontal cortex to just start doing things, and that alone builds it up.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, the amazing thing is that when you do that in meditation, you find yourself doing it when you're not meditating. You know what I mean? Because what happens is you're firing those the neural networks in specific terms in that whole top-down processing, the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, that top-down going from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala, more neurons are sent from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala. And more connections are made, and those connections become stronger, so that the prefrontal cortex can then more efficiently regulate and even inhibit some of the activity of the amygdala and other areas involved in the negative emotion generation.
And that, I have to admit, that was starting to get a little bit dense, so we got to turn that into something a little bit more real world that we can understand better.
Okay.
But if I can kind of take a stab at it,
sure.
I'm not sure I can.
Honey, you try. I've explained this to you before.
Yeah. Basically, you know, how big is the megaphone that the prefrontal cortex has directed at the amygdala, which is the source of negative emotions and, you know, bodily needs, I guess.
Yeah. Such.
And how big is the megaphone of that the amygdala has that's directed up towards the prefrontal cortex.
So we're changing the shouting match.
Yes. Changing who's in charge.
Right.
Yeah, it's not just a megaphone. They're actually directly
directing, yes.
Controlling each other.
Yep, exactly.
Through the neural network of your brain.
Yes.
And by meditation, essentially what we're doing is we're unplugging the other guy's megaphone.
Yes, we are. We are. We're quieting him. Mm-hmm. And we're telling him, we appreciate all the work that you've done. And we're really grateful, but we no longer need you for these types of activities.
So now you can go back to sleep.
Yes, please. You've caused enough trouble.
Take care of the automatic functions.
Yes, you're right.
We love you, but enough is enough.
Right, we'll let you know when we need you again.
Yeah, right. Don't call us, we'll call you.
We'll call you. Yes. Yeah, but you know, we're making light of this, but this is so very important because it's so critical. You know, not just in terms of maturity, but in terms of you know, practicing LOA and all the other things that we want to have predominate in our lives, like all the good, happy, loving, positive feelings and experiences. You know, as long as our amygdala is in charge, we're going to keep sabotaging those things. And so that's why we need the prefrontal cortex, because the prefrontal cortex is the big picture. You know, that's why sometimes when we have goals and dreams and we say we want to do this, but we find ourselves doing things that bring us the opposite, that's because the amygdala is in charge, and the ego and that whole, you know, programming that's designed to not get us what we want is running the show. But with the prefrontal cortex, assuming its rightful place as the CEO of our brain, then we can actually, you know, take charge of our lives and our experiences as we are endeavoring to do with the practice of LOA.
And since we're unplugging the metaphor, not the metaphor, the megaphone.
Yes.
Since the metaphor is that we're unplugging the megaphone, in a sense, what the metaphor is really saying, when you meditate, you're unplugging. You're unplugging,
yes,
the megaphone. You're not allowing that amygdala to shout all its nasty stuff at you anymore, because you just you tuned out.
Right.
Like, I'm exactly not going to tune into that station anymore, at least not for the next 5 minutes, because I need a break.
Right.
I need a little time out here, and we're just going to quiet things down for a bit. And that activity alone gives your will side the chance to stretch a little bit. Say,
yes.
Oh, thank goodness. I thought he'd never leave.
No, we do.
Which is helpful, especially when the neocortex is feeling weak and impotent. And, you know, I think there's an emotion there, isn't there?
Not necessarily.
No? Oh, okay. All right. I'm taking it too far.
Yeah. It's just like, well, you don't need me. I'm good.
Well, if you keep imagining, you'll create one there, but I don't think you really want to.
Maybe. We like we said in the previous show, we do create our brain. If we want to.
Yes, you're right, because it's the hardware that creates the software that creates the hardware.
Yeah.
That's the most fascinating concept of
I know.
All. The idea that something which seems to be implacable becomes placable just by using it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Superpower.
And it shows that there's hope, so that even if you're a person who has had a chronic problem, chronic pain, a chronic awfulness that has happened, and it's being done by somebody else to you, and you're the constant victim of it, well, probably the first thing to do is to make sure you move away from that person so you aren't physically in contact with it. But once you've done that, you still have to get rid of the dregs of it, the leftover that just keeps cycling through and replaying itself, the same tapes over and over again. And that's what we're talking about. Once you've actually physically moved away from the bad situation, now you can turn the tapes off, and you do it through the meditation. And when you do it through the meditation, you actually get yourself to a point where you can forgive that horrible, chronic set of events.
Yes, exactly. And you know, moving away is extremely important, and you want to do that as much as lies within your power. But even for those who are unable to move away, I always think about the story of the Auschwitz survivor.
Oh, the psychologist guy.
Yes. We just can't. But do you know his name, Walt?
I can't remember. I know who you're referring to, but right. I can't remember his
Frankel.
Name.
Viktor Frankl.
Frankl, yeah.
Yes, and so, you know, he talks about in his book about how he was able to forgive even while these people were there torturing him and doing all these evil, mean things German to him. Yeah. But he, you know, and this is a powerful testament to the use of the prefrontal cortex, because that's what he did. He used his imagination, one, to see things differently from what was happening, but also he had the theory of mind to see it from their perspective and realize that these people were the ones who were
suffering
and tormented and, you know, had very major issues. And so he realized that even though he was, quote-unquote, the prisoner, he was more free than the ones who were imprisoning him.
Because his mind was more free.
Right. And that's, he had a huge, powerful prefrontal cortex. Absolutely.
He also had a tremendous advantage in the sense that he was no longer going to be defeated.
Right.
He might be killed, but he wasn't going to be defeated.
Yes.
And he wasn't going to be defeated simply by recognizing how bad off his tormentors were.
Yes.
And realizing, thank God, I'm not like them.
Yes.
I'm better off, and that enables me to begin forgiving them, even as they're continuing to torture me.
Yes. And those are the activities that a prefrontal cortex allows you to do, to engage in, to do that kind of mental reasoning.
And I don't think it would be too much of a stretch of the imagination to think that that's probably a main reason why he survived.
Yes, I think that's a major part of the reason why he survived, absolutely.
Because one of the things that we all recognize when we're dealing with somebody who has what we might describe as an implacable way of looking at things,
mm-hmm.
especially if they're in a peaceful place, and able to do that, it becomes really difficult to try to dominate them.
Right.
And you know, he's in an environment there where there are a whole bunch of other victims. So if you're the tormentor, who are you going to pick to torment? Are you going to pick the guy who you can't get any reaction out of? Or are you going to pick the other ones who are much easier victims?
Yeah.
I think that's probably part of what happened. It literally became a sorting process, and he sorted himself out of it.
Yeah. And then, you know, there are stories of that with, to, you know, which were not as severe, we're not talking Auschwitz, but in terms of a lot of the bullying situations that happened. And, you know, Mark and I were just reading a book about this guy who was bullied for most of his middle school, a little bit through high school. But once he changed his attitude about himself, and he stopped seeing himself as the victim, so that he was no longer as bothered by the people tormenting and bullying him, then they got bored and they just left him alone.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they just kind of go away after a while.
Yeah. He's a guy that developed, or that heard about this idea of creating a mental shield.
Right, yes, exactly, yes. He heard about someone who was able to create this mental shield and imagining a big glass jar coming down over him, his entire body, kind of like, you know, in Star Trek or
Star Wars or something, I don't know.
But he would imagine that when these people were hurling the insults and whatever offenses to him, that their words would bounce on the glass and then explode.
Kaboom, kaboom, kaboom.
I guess the exploding part appeals to the adolescent male.
Yes, but it worked. It made him feel very powerful, and his whole attitude changed, and subsequently his experience with the kids at school changed. As well.
I wonder if his mind was playing Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, he had a lot of fun with that. But it shows us what's possible when we, you know, use our higher cognitive abilities.
This guy, incidentally, also became very wealthy later in life.
Right, because he...
Which he claims was based on that same ability that he developed.
Yeah, because he talked about how he joined the military and he was able to rise through the ranks and become a leader very quickly and survived all kinds of really harsh torture training because of his ability to control his mental processes, basically.
It makes a lot of sense because we think about people who are mentally hardened, people who have a very firm mindset, and they are usually the ones who succeed the best. So
yeah,
it makes total sense. I mean, the people who are able to develop that, you know, firm belief in themselves, that firm belief that, you know, nobody can hurt them and that they can be successful no matter what's happening, no matter what slings and arrows life throws at you, you can just, you know, turn the lemons into lemonade in your own mind. They believe that, and that's why they succeed.
Yeah, because he learned very early on that, you know, you don't have as much control over the stimuli that come to you in front of your environment, but you have complete control over your reaction, over your response to those things.
And your interpretation of it.
He was marching through the snow and, you know, they'd been going
for days and stuff.
Yeah, he was determined that he was not going to let what was happening around him determine how he was feeling and how he was responding. So when it got colder, he would march faster. And then
when sing songs,
when they were hungry, when he hadn't eaten for
hungry,
days,
that
right. He would start singing at the top of his lungs and stuff like that.
Now, I have to say, I really don't want to emulate him and join the army and be very cold and hungry.
No, I
think I will try to avoid that. But nevertheless, it's a tribute to him that he was able to accomplish all that.
Yeah, so the thing is, in this book, he's saying that those early years, those experiences helped him when he then decided to pursue business ventures. You know, he became a very, very successful entrepreneur.
Well, yeah, and after all that, I mean, how bad could a business failure be? I mean, it's like nothing in
comparison. Right, exactly. So when people would shoot down his ideas or things would go badly or fail or he wouldn't get, you know, whatever disaster he would encounter, he would use the same powers of mind, you know, to actually help him
shrug it off and move on.
Right, and not let that determine how he, yeah.
Right. Okay, very cool. Well, this has been, as usual, very enlightening, and I just want to say that after all this, I can now honestly say I forgive you for starting the show late. No, seriously. Forgiveness is a very cool concept. You've turned me on to something that's very good here.
It's an awesome concept, definitely, yes.
All right. Well, thank you again, Yoana, for doing all the research, because you always dig up this really cool stuff.
Yes, my pleasure.
And Mark, as usual, it's been great.
Thank you.
We'll catch you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody. It might seem crazy.